talking some playoffs, maybe some draft, and maybe I'll mix in a little college basketball too, because on occasion he'll cover a little Pac-12 basketball in the Northwest. He's with ESPN.com, one of their insider analysts, Kevin Pelton, back here on the Bill Riley Show. How are you, Kevin?
I'm good. Thanks for having me back on.
Good to have you back on again. Start first with the NBA playoffs and the game tonight. The return of Valanciunas to the lineup for Toronto tonight means what for the Raptors?
You know, I'm not sure it means that much because he's just got it's such a difficult matchup in this series the way that Cleveland is playing. I think, you know, you want to match him up against Tristan Thompson, who's more of a traditional big man, is going to be inside in the paint, isn't going to be forcing you to run around on the perimeter like Channing Frye has the last few games for Bismack Biyombo, who's much better suited to it. But at the same time, you kind of want Biyombo in there with the starters to help protect the rim. So I think we'll see how it goes. If Toronto struggles like they did in games 1 and 2 of the series on the road, especially if they have a tough time getting offense from their guards, Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan, that's where I think you see Valanciunas step into a larger role because he is someone else who can help them out offensively. But if they continue rolling kind of like they did in games 3 and 4 at home, you know, they might not need Valanciunas that much.
What do you make of the emergence of Biyombo? Has it just been right place, right time for him? Has he finally found a spot in Toronto where it works? Because he's been in the league for a while, and he was a pretty highly touted guy when he was drafted, but he's not gotten this kind of attention. What's been the difference here with Bismack Biyombo, especially this postseason?
Yeah, I think last year in Charlotte, not a lot of people obviously were watching a backup center on a lottery team in the Hornets, but Biyombo really kind of started to make this step forward last year, and then for whatever reason, just nobody paid attention to him in free agency. Masai Ujiri has a relationship with him in his role as kind of a mentor to a lot of young African players who come into the league, and they were able to leverage that into a pretty cheap deal for him to go to Toronto as a backup center. And he's had a really nice season for them defensively, protecting the rim. I think what's really surprising about this playoffs is that he's also hasn't really hurt them offensively. He's making enough plays and then has just completely dominated the glass. And it's really been impressive since Valanciunas went out. You know, they wouldn't have beaten Miami without him. And now he's kind of comfortably outplayed Tristan Thompson in this series against Cleveland, a guy who's making, you know, $15-16 million a year, and that's, I think, what we're looking at Biyombo potentially getting as a free agent this summer.
We haven't technically seen the series take a turn yet because the home team has kind of held court. What are you expecting in Game 5 tonight?
I think the whole home team continues to hold serve here. As impressive as Toronto's resilience was in the last two games, and especially I think Game 4, because that was a game Cleveland clearly wanted to get to try to have a chance to wrap up this series tonight. When you look at how Tyronn Lue extended LeBron James's minutes, had him out there for the entire second half, they really wanted that one. So that was an impressive win for Toronto. But, you know, their last three road games, they've been blown out pretty comfortably in all of them. And Kyle Lowry hasn't been the same player on the road. So I'd be surprised if they're able to continue this run down in Cleveland.
You know, we love to nitpick even the great, great players like LeBron James. I was talking about this last hour with Casey Jacobson, who played a little bit in the league and played overseas too. And as good as LeBron is, sometimes I think he gets almost too deferential to his teammates down the stretch, which is fine. I mean, he's a great, great player. But why is it, do you think, we see him and then in key situations, especially the other night, it was one or two possession game, and he instead of attacking the basket like Lowry did on one end, I know he's making the quote-unquote smart basketball play, but sometimes when it's LeBron James, I think the smart basketball play might just be attack the basket and get fouled.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's a guy who is a believer in the process, so to speak, where he's going to, you know, that has worked out very well for him over the course of the career, and he's going to keep doing it. And, you know, then the interesting dynamic here is in Cleveland, you've got a guy in Kyrie Irving who wants the ball a lot in those situations and is used to playing that role over the course of his entire career as well until LeBron came there. So a little bit of tension, you know, there that they've worked through pretty well in the postseason. But, you know, more often than not, it's paid off for LeBron.
So we shifted to the West, where last night Oklahoma City showed once again how very, very good they are. Golden State hasn't looked right for most of this series. The plus-minus, obviously, for all their big three has been extraordinarily bad. Thompson was good last night, but nobody else really was. you've watched this team play a lot. You've watched a lot of Western Conference basketball this year. What are you seeing with the Golden State Warriors? What's changed, or better yet, and I asked this question at the top of my show for the listeners today, is it about Golden State, or has this been more about what Oklahoma City's done, Kevin?
I think any time that you have a result this unexpected, it's probably a little of both. So it starts with, you know, the Thunder's size and length and athleticism and the fact that they can go to this quote-unquote small lineup where they've taken Steven Adams off the court and put Serge Ibaka at center. But much like Golden State, they still have big, long, interchangeable players at every position, and that's causing the Warriors a lot of problems with the deflected passes, the steals that they're coming up with. The Warriors haven't been able to adjust to the passing lanes not being the same. And then also at the rim, I mean, I think, you know, probably the most impressive play of last night was the play where Kevin Durant goes to one side of the hoop to challenge Draymond Green's potential layup attempt, and then, you know, he finds Sean Livingston for what looks to all of us like it's going to be an easy dunk, and somehow Durant managed to change directions and block that shot at the rim. And then, you know, you've seen that with Steph Curry, who's had a tough time finishing this series. Other Golden State guards just are making different decisions than they're used to because of that. And that's, I think, where it is on the Warriors, because they look shaken. They look like they, what's been working for them all season long is no longer working, and that's, I think, you know, caused them to start second-guessing things, start doubting things, and speeding things up, and that's what's caused some of these turnovers as well. You know, it'll be interesting to see whether they can regain that confidence back at home. That Oklahoma City crowd was terrific, and certainly we've seen role players like Andre Roberts and, you know, guys like that, Deion Waiters as well. They've been much more productive for the Thunder at home than they were in the Bay Area in the first couple of games of this series. So I think the Warriors have a chance to change the script a little bit on what Saturday night, I guess, is the Thursday night is the next game of the series.
Yes.
But they're still going to have to win a game in Oklahoma City to win this series, and that looks like a real challenge for them right now.
How much of this is Oklahoma City being very, very good, but maybe the Warriors not having a counter move? You know, it's that old, this is what we've done all year, and we've been so very, very good at it. Is this time now, four games in, that may, is there an adjustment that Steve Kerr needs to make? Because it seems like Billy Donovan, you know, they lose the three games in the regular season. They were close in a couple of those games, but Billy figured something out perhaps in those three games in the regular season, and they've found that adjustment. Is there a counter move that you can see for Golden State?
Well, it's interesting because all year long, you know, the small lineup has been their counter adjustment. Steve Kerr has saved in his back pocket for whenever he's needed it, and he's gone to it the last two games, and has just gotten destroyed by this Oklahoma City small lineup, which absolutely none of us saw coming. I think one, you know, simple thing that would help the Warriors out quite a bit is to start switching more defensively. That Andre Roberson pick and roll that was causing them a lot of problems in the fourth quarter last night, that's something they can probably fairly comfortably switch and not end up with two problematic mismatches. And that's, you know, one of the appeals of this death lineup, the small lineup for the Warriors, is the ability to switch everything. So it's kind of curious that they haven't gone to that. But, you know, a lot of it is just going to be execution and then also at times shot making. You know, they've gotten some good looks over the last couple of games in Oklahoma City that haven't gone down. And obviously Steph Curry's shot making is not nearly at the same place it was, you know, before he suffered that sprained MCL a few weeks ago.
Yeah, that was kind of the narrative that's popped up the last couple of games, that maybe Steph isn't 100%. He doesn't seem to have the explosion. He can get hot, and he and Klay Thompson have gotten hot, but it doesn't appear that he's 100%, does it?
No, and I'll give Nate Duncan credit on his great podcast. He's been bringing this up since Curry came back in game four of that Portland series. You know, despite the fact that he had the explosion against the Blazers and, you know, made a bunch of shots in game five to close out that series and then had the big game two against Oklahoma City, he's been very consistent this whole time saying that Curry just doesn't quite have that same athletic explosion as we're used to seeing from him. And the place it's really showing up, I think, in this series is when the Warriors get a big man switched out on Curry. You remember last year's playoffs throughout the regular season this year. That was it. It was over. Steph Curry was either going to blow by you and get to the basket, or he was going to make a three over you. And in this series, Steven Adams has blocked his shot a couple of times. Pretty much anyone except Enes Kanter has been able to slow him down one-on-one after those switches.
Draymond Green hasn't looked the same either, and it's really it seemed like it started the other night after the kick on Steven Adams. I've maintained as great as Steph Curry is, I think the guy that's the proverbial stir that draws the straw that stirs the drink for the Warriors is Draymond Green. I don't think they're going to go anywhere if he doesn't get back and play.
Agreed, and I think also it's playing into Curry's slump a little bit, because part of what they like to do is put Curry off the ball and let Draymond run the offense as the point guard, and you know, free Curry up with some off-ball screens. And Oklahoma City has done a really nice job with that. They're also probably getting away with a little bit of holding. I think you know, Jazz fans might be familiar with that in late game situations. But Draymond's just not making good decisions right now. He's not making good reads. It seems like he's trying to do a little bit too much on his own at times. He's forcing passes. You know, you think of he's overthrown Festus Ezeli a few times on lobs, things like that. And mentally, I don't know if it's, again, dealing with the Oklahoma City athleticism and the fact that, you know, they're able to go toe for toe with him in a way that most teams aren't when the Warriors go small, but he doesn't seem to be quite there.
I know they can win three in a row because they've done it. Do you think the Warriors will win three in a row?
At this point, it's a long shot. You know, I'd give them maybe a 15% chance of winning the series. But the one thing I will say is, you know, if they just can win game five at home, as we'd expect that they probably would, given the way they've dominated at home all season, then the pressure does start to flip really quickly to Oklahoma City, because if you're the Thunder, you're thinking, we need to win this game six at home because we do want no part of a game seven at Oracle. Certainly the Thunder could win that, but it pushes them to a must win, I think, in a hurry if the Warriors can win.
All right, the Jazz had some guys in today, interesting guys working out. I don't know how much you've gotten into draft mode yet, Kevin, but I'm curious what you know about this kid Thon Maker. He was in today. I know he's got those crazy measurables. Apparently he's an affable kid who's interviewed very, very well. But I've looked at a lot of mock drafts, and they've got him down toward the end of the first round for a guy that's got so much potential. It seems pretty low. What do you know about Maker and his story coming into this year's NBA draft?
So I had a chance to watch him last year at the Nike Hoop Summit, which is, you know, one of probably his most prominent appearances in front of NBA scouts, who have
right.
an opportunity to watch those practices and the game and get to see all of the international practices that he was a part of. So in that setting, you know, I don't think he was nearly as impressive as a guy like Skal Labissiere, who's also in this year's draft and is probably considered a late lottery 10 to 14 range, probably actually around where Utah is picking. It's his. So he was pretty comfortably outplayed by Labissiere. I mean, the thing that stood out is, you know, the mixed tapes gives this impression of Maker as a guy who's handling the ball a lot, and he got compared to Kevin Durant based on them. And that's not really his game. He's more of an energy, athletic big man. Now, that can be a really good player if he, you know, settles in, is a finisher off the pick and roll, a guy who can play above the rim and then protect the rim and then maybe switch a little bit using his athleticism on defense. That could be a good player, but we're also probably a couple of years away from him getting to that point because he's just got so little high-level experience at this point, you know, having played Canadian high school basketball last year.
So Labissiere outplayed him, and he didn't play much at Kentucky, but just having that 1 year of Kentucky basketball under his belt would put him 10, 15 spots ahead of Maker, you think, at this point in time?
Well, it's interesting because Labissiere, based on that, you know, I thought watching him from that week, to me, he was the best prospect, better than Ben Simmons, better than
right.
Brandon Ingram, guys who were also there. And then he just never translated that really at Kentucky other than a couple of brief stretches. But I think still what scouts saw there in terms of that potential for him to be an elite player gives him, you know, lottery pedigree, despite the fact that he had a disappointing season at Kentucky.
So if he's being projected late first round right now, good workouts, apparently he had a good one today for the Utah Jazz. How far up do you think somebody might take a chance on a guy like Maker? Just outside the lottery, mid first round, or is that still too early?
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, probably middle of the first round is probably an appropriate place for him. You know, it's interesting because I think scouts usually have such a tendency to fall in love with young athletic guys like this that I think they've started to maybe go a little bit too far the other way in terms of skepticism. We saw this, I thought, a couple years ago with Clint Capella, another guy who had a fairly disappointing Hoop Summit, but his performance overseas in France had suggested, you know, this is a guy who can be a very productive player. It took him basically an entire year. He spent most of his rookie season in the D League, but then he came on last year for Houston in the playoffs and had a very nice season for them this year. Looks like potentially their future starter at center. So I think that's a good comparison for what kind of player Thon could become.
All right, I'm going to hit one more topic with you, Kevin, then I'll let you go. We were talking some Pac-12 basketball, and Oregon, you know, you may or may not have seen, got some pretty good news today with Dylan Brooks and Tyler Dorsey deciding to take their names out of the draft and returning to Oregon. I look at it and I think Oregon now is probably my preseason team to beat in the Pac-12 conference. But if you look down a little bit, I was surprised. I didn't know what Washington would have this past year. I thought Lorenzo Romar had a terrific recruiting class and really got the most out of those kids. But Marquise Chris, who I loved, and DeJounte Murray are both jumping into the NBA draft. So what's your take? Because I know you're up that direction. You see a little bit of Washington basketball. What's your takeaway on what Romar's got coming in and coming back, and where you would kind of put them in the preseason hierarchy?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting because they've got Markel Fultz, who in this year's Hoop Summit at the McDonald's game, really impressed. I think he's up to number 2 on Draft Express's 2017 mock draft at this point. So he's a guy who can come in and I think be an impact player right away, which is what the Huskies are going to need with the departure of Murray and Chris. The front court looks really good. You got a lot of depth and a lot of size there, even with Chris's departure. The question is just who kind of helps carry the load for Markel Fultz in the backcourt. I think they're going to really need David Crisp, who played a little bit off the bench as a freshman, to step up this year. And, you know, they were hoping, I really think, after Murray left to add a graduate transfer so they had just a little bit more experience in the backcourt. Not getting one of those guys so far has made it more difficult, I think. So, you know, probably looking at somewhere in the middle of the Pac-12, like much like they were last year, you know, with a chance to be an NCAA tournament team if everything breaks right.
A lot of talented freshmen coming into the league. Is this kid Fultz have a chance to be the freshman of the year?
He does. He's that good. A terrific pick-and-roll player, a guy who can shoot the ball a little bit, handles it a great deal. He reminds me, he's not quite this level of shooter, but he reminds me a lot of D'Angelo Russell.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. I honestly had no idea. I didn't think Washington would be much, but he maximized those freshmen. And you mentioned the front court's very, very good. They'll have to replace Andrew's scoring as well. I mean, as good as Murray and Chris were, Andrew Andrews was kind of the senior heartbeat of that team, and he came up with a lot of big buckets for him, so they'll have to replace that as well.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's sort of what we don't talk about because he was just expected to be gone, but he was certainly the best player on the Huskies last year, the most consistent player, and you know, so losing those three guys when you add him in with Chris and Fultz, that's a lot of missing talent. But they do have young guys, so hopefully they take a step forward in their development next year.
Yeah, the Murray thing was, I thought he could have used another year. Chris, they could all use another year, but I think Marquise Chris could be a really, really special player. I know the Jazz have him in here as well to take a look because he's going to go in that same range. He's being projected in that probably, you know, 10 to 15, 16 range with that crazy jumping ability, but that ability to jump out on the floor and shoot that jump shot, too.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he goes even higher than that. I think he makes a lot of sense for Toronto at the 9th pick as a fit for what they need. So, yeah, if you're a lottery pick at that point, I think you probably have to go. It's interesting now there's a lot of rumors based on the fact that Murray didn't go to the pre-draft camp, and I don't know that he's been working out yet, that maybe he has a promise from someone in the first round, which would be good news for him.
Absolutely it would be. Kevin, thanks so much. Enjoy the stuff at ESPN.com, and we'll talk to you again.
All right, thanks for having me.
Kevin Pelton with us, ESPN.com, NBA Insider. Covers a little college and draft stuff, too, here on The Bill Riley Show.